I hope you enjoy this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to them. And your support, or dana, also makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much. So I want to start by sharing an old story from the Mahayana tradition that I love that's called Castles of Sand. And the rendition of this story that I want to share with you tonight is from a wonderful book of ancient Buddhist tales and parables called Kindness, A Treasury of Buddhist Wisdom for Children and Parents. I think I've mentioned this one before. It's so good. So this is the story. Along the banks of a wide, lazy river, a number of children were playing on a lovely beach in the afternoon sunshine. These were ancient times, but the same story could be told now. Whenever children enjoy the irresistible magic of water and sand, on this particular day, castles quickly sprouted across the length of the shoreline beneath busy hands. And the longer each child attended to his or her castle, the more carefully each guarded it and felt a need to keep it separate from their neighbors. Soon there was no mistaking which castle and which territory belonged to whom. But eventually, as it often happens, a child slips or falls clumsily upon a neighboring castle, or someone makes a comparison between castles, or a child acquires a special stick or shell to ornament her fortress, and so it stands more proudly than the others do. On this day, when such a mistake was made, an insult was carelessly tossed about, and the insulted child ran up and stomped on the offender's castle. The lord of the newly wrecked castle pulled the attacker's hair and shouted to the others to help administer justice. The boy was soon chased from the beach and given a kick or two for good measure. Then the children returned to expanding their own castles and provinces, each saying, "Don't touch. Hey, look at my castle. Mine is the best. Mine is the biggest." A short time later, the sun began to set. Dusk arrived, and the children knew they were expected home for supper. Suddenly, it seems as if no one had ever cared about castles. So you can see so much metaphor in that, right? Yeah. Squeals of joy were heard in the delight of destroying the day's work. Some kicked their castles apart. Others dissolved them with buckets of water. Then one and all turned towards home and left. In the quiet, only the pleasant tapping of the river against the shore was heard. And night long, the river gently smoothed the sand again. So I think this story so simply exemplifies what I want to talk about tonight again, which is the Buddhist teaching on the eight worldly winds. And these also, not to confuse you, but these go by the eight vicissitudes, the eight worldly vicissitudes, the eight worldly concerns, or dharmas, or conditions, or attachments. So if you go look them up, you'll find all those different varieties. And before we go into these eight, I would like you to recall the Buddhist teachings on the first and second noble truths, okay? And these, of course, tell us that there is suffering, right? And there's a reason for this suffering. And that reason for suffering is tanha, which is clinging, right? Or our unwillingness or maybe inability to let go of what are considered, again, another list, the three poisons, right? Or maybe the three unwholesome roots. And these, of course, are greed and attachment, or wanting, are wanting, and aversion or hatred are not wanting, so wanting, not wanting. And then the third of these, of course, is delusion, which is essentially kind of summarized as not understanding that the first two cause us suffering, that wanting and not wanting causes suffering. That's kind of the summary of that. And I mention these because the eight worldly winds, whenever they blow in, we suffer when we react or respond to these winds with the three poisons. Okay, so these eight then include four main things that we like and tend to become attached to, four main things that we don't like and try to avoid, and these are also often thought of as our main hopes and fears, if that's helpful. So these eight are actually four pairs of opposites, which also make them easier to remember, okay? And I'm right now regretting not handing these out to you on a sheet of paper so you can remember them, but maybe you can look them up when you get home. But these four pairs of opposites are pleasure and pain, okay, gain and loss, status or reputation, and disgrace or bad reputation. And the fourth one is praise and blame, okay? And these are the eight worldly winds. They blow in and they blow out, right? They swirl through our lives constantly, just like the weather, don't they? And on some days, of course, it can be incredibly windy or stormy. And it can feel like, you know, we're experiencing all of these in the same day sometimes, right? The problem is that instead of allowing ourselves to simply experience the wind, what we do is we tend to interpret whatever the wind brought in, okay? And then we tend to create a sense of self from whatever the wind blew in, okay? So in other words, we tend to create our own sandcastles from whatever the wind has blown in, maybe a whole city of these sandcastles sometimes that we can construct on our own. The Tibetan Buddhist master Lama Yeshe calls this the constant yo-yo effect. And he describes it this way. I get a present. I feel so happy. I lost that wonderful gift. I'm so unhappy. Somebody says, you're wonderful. And we fill up. Somebody says, you made a mistake. And then our mood goes down. It's a yo-yo effect. So let me read these eight again to you just briefly, and I want you to consider if you've experienced them in any way, in some form, just today. Just today. Okay, just consider, okay? And see if you can also, at the same time, if something comes up, recall your reaction. Okay? So you might even close your eyes for this. You don't have to, but it can be brief. So pleasure. Pleasure. Pain. Pain. Gain. Do you receive something? Gain. What about loss? Was your reputation in any way boosted? Or maybe deflated? Disgrace? What about praise? You get praised in any way today about something? Did you get blamed for anything today? Anybody blame you or criticize you today in some way? Okay, you can open your eyes. This is really a brief thing. Did anybody have all of them? Experience all of them today? No? Some of them? At least one? At least one, everybody? Yeah.
Most of them.
Yeah. So according to the teachings, these winds themselves are actually really not the problem. Otherwise, life itself would be a problem, right? If you think about it. That's why they're called the winds. They blow in constantly. They're swirling around. So we all experience these winds. And, you know, in the words of Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh, this is it. This is it. This is life. It's the condition of our lives. Or as Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn calls it, this is the full catastrophe. You know, this is it. So the experience, it's important to remember the experience of pleasure, pain, gain, loss, reputation, disgrace, praise, and blame is not the problem, right? It's just life. It's the tide that washes these castles away constantly every day. For instance, when talking about receiving blame, there's a very famous passage in the Dhammapada where the Buddha tells us this has been going on throughout the ages. They criticize the silent ones. They criticize the talkative ones. They criticize the moderate ones. There is no one in the world that escapes criticism. This never was and never will be, nor is there now, the wholly criticized or the wholly approved. And in fact, of course, the Buddha himself was criticized quite a bit in his day. And so here's this great spiritual leader, this fully enlightened being, and even he is not immune to criticism, to praise and blame. Okay, you would just expect the Buddha to be constantly praised, right? That's not the case. So there is not also not a single person among us who will not experience pleasure or pain or gain or loss, success, failure of some sort, right? So again, none of these things in and of themselves are a problem, and they don't necessarily need to bring us suffering. What does tend to bring us a tremendous amount of pain and frustration and suffering is how we react to these experiences and what we think of these experiences, our attachment to them, our aversion, the stories that we create, right? Or wanting things to be different than they actually are. That's what causes us our suffering. And of course, we tend to struggle the most with how these winds reflect on our sense of self, about what we think and believe they tell us about who we are and what our lives look like. That's what we tend to struggle the most with, isn't it, if we're honest? So again, it's what we make of what the wind blows in, those sandcastles. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who wrote a whole book about these eight, says it this way. He says, wealth is not a problem. The problem is having desire for wealth. Friends are not a problem. Attachment to our friends is. Objects are not a problem for us. Objects become a problem for us because of the emotional mind of desire. When desire is there, not only does a lack of wealth cause us problems, but so too does having wealth. When we are controlled by the eight worldly dharmas, we're miserable and lonely without friends, but having friends does not give us complete satisfaction either. And when our mind is controlled by desire, either having or not having an object cannot bring anything but dissatisfaction. And there's so much truth in this. And it's also true that our attachment and aversion to these all of these things is our basic human tendency. That's kind of the bad news in a way, right? It's our wanting and are not wanting, our hoping and our fearing. We all do this. For instance, we all like pleasure, right? Yes, we can agree on that. We all like pleasure. Of course we do. The problem is, right, we tend to become attached to it or addicted to it, or we want even more and more and more of it, and we also want it to last. We don't want it to go away, right? We want our pleasure to be permanent Or maybe we're afraid of not getting it in some way, or we're afraid of losing it. Okay, all of those things. We also tend to dislike pain, yes? So this includes both mental and physical pain. And so our tendency, of course, our very human tendency, is to want to avoid it, to not want it, to run away from it. And then we struggle with it. We don't want it, so then we struggle with it, and then we fight it, and we resist it, which, of course, as we all know, those of us who have tried it, it just makes it that much worse, right? The teachings tell us that. Most of us, I assume, are also very attracted to, and some of us addicted to, praise, right? Wanting that. And we like it, most of us, and we tend to want more and more of it. Or maybe we're afraid that we won't get enough of it, right? It's like in some way you might notice that we're constantly running around and asking everyone, it just in some way, how am I doing? How am I doing? Am I okay? How am I doing? Am I okay? What do you think about me? Right? There's so many ways that we do this. And, of course, most of us would also agree we want to avoid blame and criticism. Nobody wants that, right? And we also tend to like and are attached to a sense of being someone, of success, of having a good reputation, our perceived status, you know, which is a sign of our okayness, right? Think about that. If we're asking, how am I doing? We want to make sure that we have that kind of status or reputation in our relationships. What's your status in your relationships? Or your family, you know, in your friendships or at work or in your communities, in the world. How often do we think about that? What's my status in all of these venues? And so because of this, we might then put a lot of effort into building this up, the sense of self, and then maintaining it and protecting it, you know, and wanting more and more praise. And if we're honest, you know, we really don't want to be second at this in any way, do we? Right? Anybody? Anybody want to be second? I don't see any hands raised. Right? We tend to want to be the best or the most important, most successful. Best mom, best dad, you know, best sibling. Anybody in here have sibling rivalry? Everybody? You know? The best son or daughter, the best employee, best everything. And of course, we also dislike and try to avoid disgrace, a sense of failure, losing our status or reputation, not being seen as something or someone. And, of course, especially in our Western culture, we tend to be very attached to gain, to having some kind of material wealth, or you can look at it as we expect to get what we want, you know, sometimes almost instantly, right? We want that instant satisfaction. We want it right now. And we mostly don't like the thought of not getting what we want, right, or losing what we have. So that's kind of a summary of the eight, and they seem pretty obvious, but they are actually each very complicated if you start really investigating them, and they affect all aspects of our lives. We could do a whole year-long study on the eight worldly winds, just picking them apart. They're that important, and they affect that much of our lives. And so because they affect so much of our lives, it's important that we use our practice to really start seeing them so much more clearly and see all the ways that we cling to what is pleasurable and resist what is painful. So we really want to get to know how we do this and become really familiar with it and intimate with how we do this. A very simple way to start this practice, actually, is to simply start noticing or noting, labeling all your wanting and not wanting thoughts. This can be a little crazy making, But it's a good way to start, you know, in your meditation practice, just noting, wanting, not wanting, wanting, not wanting. Just notice it, okay? And simply becoming really curious about it, as always, without judgment, you know, with a tremendous amount of kindness and compassion. That's how we practice. We're not trying to be averse to our aversion or our greed, because that's bringing aversion into the mix again. My favorite Buddhist nun, Pema Chodron, tells us, we want to know our pain so we can stop endlessly running. We want to know our pleasure so we can stop endlessly grasping. Then somehow our questions get bigger and our inquisitiveness more vast. We want to know about loss so we might understand other people when their lives are falling apart. We want to know about gain so we might understand other people when they're delighted or when they get arrogant and puffed up and carried away. When we become more insightful and compassionate about how we ourselves get hooked, we spontaneously feel more tenderness for the human race. So that's the first step, really, is to getting to know how we get hooked. How do I get hooked? What's my personal way or ways of becoming hooked on these things? Okay. The second step is to remind ourselves that once we see and get to know all the ways that we're grasping or avoiding, there's, again, no need to try to get rid of our desires or our resistance, right? Unfortunately, again, this only adds aversion into the mix, which again, as we all know, tends to make it that much worse. So what this practice is asking us to do, instead of resisting and trying to control, is to simply notice, become very aware of how our emotions are fueled by these winds. How are my emotions, how do I react to all of these winds, these things that are coming in? And then to ask ourselves, really, what is fueling them? What's fueling them? What thoughts and beliefs are creating these emotions? Okay. And as we do, we also need to consciously remind ourselves that just like those sandcastles, these emotions and even our thoughts are not solid. Right? They're not permanent. They're not even real. They're not who we are. They're not who we are. So even though something might look like a real sandcastle, we have to remember that these things are created by mind. They're really only made of sand, if you will, and they're only what we make of them, right? So whenever we're absolutely convinced, for instance, that what we're seeing and believing and thinking about is real, that it's like a solid sandcastle with all its moats and windows and flags, if you will, we are essentially caught up in the poison of delusion, that third poison, and we're going to actually create some real and maybe sometimes ongoing suffering for ourselves by really putting a lot of stock into what is essentially a sandcastle. Okay, you guys with me? So just as a for instance, so often we can create our own reality by believing something about someone with very little evidence, sometimes with no evidence whatsoever, right? And yet we can get so caught up in our belief and create so much pain and suffering around it simply by how we are imagining how that person is perceiving us, maybe, or how that person's behaving. We've got it all made up in our mind. That's exactly what it is. And almost always, by the way, we've created these beliefs or this belief, the sandcastle, out of very old ancient conditioning. So it's like the old ancient sand of our habitual ways of thinking, if you can think about it like that. We take the sand of ancient conditioning and we make it into a sandcastle. And this person over here is going to have another one, but we believe that they're true. So again, it's important that we use our practice to become more aware of how we think about these eight things. Because as the Buddha taught, the way we think about things not only affects the quality of our actual lives, but it also tends to shape our behaviors and our actions in the world. Really important. In the Loka Vipati Sutta, where the Buddha first introduces the teachings of the eight worldly winds, he says this, monks, which means us, monks, these eight worldly conditions spin after the world, and the world spins after these eight worldly conditions. Which eight? Gain, loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. These are the eight worldly conditions that spin after the world, and the world spins after these eight worldly conditions. And so this spinning, if you will, not only includes our thoughts that spin and create our mental and emotional reality, but again, our actions and behaviors, right? They spin. So for instance, an example of this, you know, maybe we want some kind of praise, maybe from our boss or our spouse or one of our parents. And our sense of self is really attached to receiving that praise, right? How is this going to affect our behavior, right? So maybe we might consider, what kinds of things might we be doing to receive that praise, right? Maybe someone we don't think likes us that much. How do we behave? You know, how does that fuel our behavior? Or maybe we're really attached to the worldly win of gain. This is an interesting one. And we feel like it's important for our sense of self to accumulate more and more and more and more and more for our sense of self. So like maybe we feel like we won't be truly happy until we have the best clothes, the best furniture, the best house, the best yard, the best car. You know, maybe the best and the biggest hotel in the world. I'm just saying. Right? What kinds of things do we then become willing to do in order to get what we want? So you can look at this, how it can manifest on small levels, but massive levels, this worldly win of gain. And the same, of course, goes for success, reputation, status. What types of things do we try to build up and do to maintain and build up this sense of self? Right? The sense of status. So on the flip side, right, which is aversion, not wanting, we might consider what kind of things do we do to avoid experiencing a loss of any of these things, a loss of praise, a loss of material things, a loss of our status. What kinds of things do we do? Or even, what do we do to avoid allowing ourselves to feel any kind of pain? That's a big one. You could chew on that for a long time, right? And how does this avoiding truly affect the quality of our lives? How does your avoiding pain affect the quality of your life? What ways do you do that? Just consider. And so in all of these things, whenever we're battling with life itself, trying to avoid or constantly struggling for more of what we think will bring us happiness, we suffer. The Buddhist nun Thupten Children tells us, this expression, struggling for happiness, perfectly expresses what the eight worldly concerns are about. We struggle for happiness, constantly trying to rearrange our world to get wealth, praise and approval, good reputation and sense pleasure, and to avoid lack, blame, bad reputation and unpleasant sensations. Life becomes a battle with the environment and the people in it as we try to be near everything we like and get far away from or destroy anything we dislike. This brings us so much grief and suffering because our mind is so reactive. We also create a lot of negative karma, which brings future misery. And we're too busy to practice the path that makes our lives meaningful and leads to genuine peace and joy. Too busy doing all those other things. And so as we investigate these eight worldly winds more closely, we might also begin to notice that the way we tend to react to them, how we react to them, are all ways that we're trying to create a solid, permanent sense of self, right? A self that we feel like we need to either constantly prop up or defend, you know, or build up in some way. When in reality, again, we ourselves are just like those sandcastles, the teachings show us. Our sense of self is simply been created by mind, and we ourselves are constantly flowing. Our sense of self is constantly flowing, isn't it? Right? Just like that sand. We are impermanent, as is everything else, as is are all the conditions in our lives that also arise and pass, and arise and pass again constantly. Lama Zopa Rinpoche tells us, look at children playing in the sand. They make piles of sand and give them labels, calling one pile my house and another my car. They believe in their labels and grasp onto them, and when challenged, they argue and fight as attachment, hatred, and anger arise. Clinging to the eight worldly dharmas, we are just like children. In fact, we're completely childish. We chase the meaningless in search of happiness. We believe the essenceless to have essence. In the Lokavibhati Sutta, where he introduces these eight, the Buddha tells us, gain, loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, pain, these conditions among human beings are inconstant, impermanent, subject to change. Knowing this, the wise person, mindful, ponders these changing conditions. Desirable things don't charm the mind. Undesirable ones bring no resistance. Ones welcoming and rebelling are scattered, gone to their end, do not exist. So what the Buddha here is pointing out is the practice of equanimity or balanced awareness, cultivating a sense of balance and ease in the midst of all these fluid, changing, impermanent conditions, in the midst of these winds. So with equanimity practice, we're learning that we really need to let things flow through, again, just like the wind, to see their arising and an inevitable passing and the continuation of this, that it just arises and passes constantly, right? As Bhikkhu Anayu says, sums up the whole practice, I said this during meditation practice tonight, keep calmly knowing change. Keep calmly, calmly knowing change. Another word that's often translated as equanimity is tatra maja tata, which means ultimately to stand in the middle of all of this. Okay, so the Buddha tells us, praise and blame, recognition and disregard, gain and loss, pleasure and sorrow, come and go like the wind. Rest like a giant tree in the midst of them all. Rest like a giant tree in the midst of them all. And if you recall, the Buddha actually termed the whole practice as the middle way. So when we're walking on the path of the middle way, what we begin to realize more and more through our practice is that our happiness is actually at the center of wanting and not wanting. Happiness is at the center of that. So happiness happens when we're not clinging to anything that is impermanent, which means everything, including ourselves, right? So we do this by recognizing that nothing is really happy or unhappy in and of itself, no thing, no person, no situation, but in how we're thinking about it and how we're relating to it, right? Remembering that even these things are ephemeral or not real, it's really, truly only what we make of them, to bring up the sandcastles again. And I want to end tonight with a wonderful old story about the eight worldly winds that I learned from Ajahn Brahm. And in this story, the eight winds are actually called four, since the pairs are linked, so they call them the four worldly winds. So a long time ago, a monk lived on a secluded island in the middle of this large lake, and he had left his teacher's monastery with the intention of not returning until he had reached full enlightenment. And so for years, his days were spent in total solitude. He didn't even see the person who had rowed over to his island on a weekly basis to bring him supplies. Didn't see the guy. And one night, after a particularly blissful sit, on the night of the full moon, the monk believed that he'd done it. He'd reached full enlightenment. And so he said, wow, you know, out of deep compassion, I need to share my wisdom with others, but first I need to tell my teacher. He has to know first, right? And so carefully and very beautifully, he penned these words onto a thick piece of parchment. The monk, meditating diligently, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. So he wrote these words on parchment. And the next time the small supply boatman arrived, the monk went out and greeted him in person for the first time ever. And he handed him the scroll case with the parchment, and he said, please take this back to my teacher. Please take this back. So the boatman did what he was asked, and he took it back. So after a whole week had passed, and the boatman hadn't been there, the young monk walked down to the water very early in the morning, and he kind of was scanning the horizon for his teacher, and he believed his teacher would probably arrive in a grand boat with, you know, the rest of the monastic community along with him. And of course, he would treat them all to his wisdom if that was so. It wouldn't be right, you know, to hold it back. And so finally on the horizon, the monk saw a small boat, and he thought, oh, you know, my teacher has come by himself first, right, to congratulate me. And as the boat drew nearer, he saw that it was just the boatman, same boatman, who, after unloading the supplies, handed him back what looked like the same piece of parchment that he'd written. And he took it out of its case and unrolled it, and in his beautiful black calligraphy, it said, the monk, meditating diligently, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. And across his beautifully crafted penmanship in red ink were four words. Fart, 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 fart. The monk was furious. He stomped on the boat and demanded, take me to the master right now. Take me to him. So the monk left his island, and he went back to the monastery that he left so many years ago, and without knocking, he marched into the master's study, rushed to his desk, slammed down the parchment, and demanded, what is the meaning of this? And very calmly, the master looked at him and said, the monk meditating diligently is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. And yet four little farts have blown you all the way across the lake. It's a classic Buddhist story. I'm so glad I could share that with you. All right. So I want to end, I think, with a contemplation of the eight winds. So I'm going to invite you all into a seated posture and Close the eyes if you'd like. It's very brief. And just take a nice deep breath in and out. Maybe a couple of rounds of these just to settle the mind and the body here. Come back into your body if you've left it. And as always with these contemplations, whenever you'd like to, you can always place a hand on the heart or both hands on the heart or one hand on the belly, one hand on the heart, whatever you'd like or not, it's fine. Whatever you'd like is fine. Just breathing, feeling the breath move in the body, dropping the shoulders. Letting the face be soft, tummy soft, hands soft. And I ask you some questions, some self-inquiry, remembering that there's no judgment at all, ever. Just curiosity, you really want to see this clearly, with kindness. Ah, this is true. So the first inquiry is just to notice, how do I feel and react when someone praises me? Just notice what happens. What happens when someone praises me? How does that feel in the body, and how do you react? Now the opposite, how do I feel when someone blames me? How do I feel and react when someone blames me? When I experience the wind of blame. How do I feel when I've gained something? How do I feel and react? When I experience the wind of gain, what about when you experience the wind of loss? When you've lost something? How do you feel and react? This could be something, even just something small, doesn't have to be big. It could be as simple as the internet going out, or how do you feel when you've lost something? How do you react? And what about when your status is in some way threatened? How do you feel and react or behave when your sense of status is in some way threatened? Your good reputation, success, your standing. In the same way you might notice how you feel and react to an elevated status of some sort, do you cling to it? Just notice. When you feel pleasure or pain, do you simply feel pleasure or pain? Or might there be a whole narrative or story that goes along with it? This is, could be emotional or physical, pleasure and pain. You might now just make an intention to really allow yourself to notice your wanting and not wanting with great curiosity and kindness. Make an intention for yourself to be willing to be aware of the 8 worldly winds and see if you can simply experience them without creating a narrative of self around it, a narrative of self. Planting that seed of intention. Finally, just listening to these words from Rumi, who writes, "This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond."